The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Great to be with you. This week, progressives attempt to lure Christians leftward.
He actually said that. He said both the Constitution and the Bible are socialist documents.
The 2020 presidential election has a role for believers.
We have to remember where our identity ultimately lies. And it's a lot more complicated than that in practice, but it's also very simple. If we remember that we're Christians first, everything else should fall into place.
We'll also look at how to raise successful teens.
Every parent needs to know this. Satan hates your kids.
And Max Lucado's latest book has a timeless message.
People are longing to be happy in this day and age.
We have all this and more. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. Catch my program live each weekday afternoon on WAVA.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. For quite some time, the left has shunned Bible-believing voters. They've mocked their belief system, legislated against their values, and worked to keep them out of politics. But lately, they've attracted a religious group they rather like, self-described Christians who hold to a far-left belief system, a very non-threatening version of Christianity, one where you can pretty much believe anything you like and still call yourself a believer. Paul Kengor, author of the book Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, noticed these interesting religious folks are now welcomed into the Democratic Party. His recent article caught my attention. The title, Does the Religious Left Know What Lenin Said About Christianity and Socialism? I invited him on my program on WAVA in Washington, D.C. First, who exactly is this Reverend William Barber? And second, how have we come to the place where such as he, and I know sadly he's not alone, are actually hijacking the U.S. Constitution and even the Bible itself in the name of being socialist documents?
Yeah, and he actually said that. He said both the Constitution and the Bible are socialist documents. And, you know, here you have the Democratic National Committee, which just after that meeting, Don, in fact, well, about a week or two before that meeting, had issued its resolution where it was seeking out the so-called nuns, the people with no religious affiliation. It was making a push, a bid for non-religious and even atheistic and agnostic voters. And then on a dime, they spin around and they invite in the Reverend William Barber, who talks about, you know, there he is to bring religion, right, to bring religion to the DNC. And I guess as long as he does it in a fashion where he talks about Jesus not wanting to charge a leper a copay, and if he can talk about religion in a socialistic way, then he's completely welcome. And if you watch the video where he says that, Tom Perez, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who said that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez represents the future of the Democratic Party, he leaps to his feet in applause. The whole place did. So a week or two earlier, prior to that, they probably would have leapt to their applause for somebody saying, keep religion out of our party. And now here they are, leaping to their feet in applause for a guy who wants to bring socialism and religion together. So it's kind of, there's an incongruity there. But it's not that surprise given the influence that the religious left has today within the Democratic Party.
Paul, talk, if you would, about something that sadly needs to be said. Folks need to be, I was going to say reminded, but I'm afraid millions of Americans need to be informed for the first time as to what Marx and Lenin really thought of and said about religion.
Well, that's right, Don. And they said that religion and communism were incompatible. In fact, Marx said that communism begins where atheism begins. I mean, that's pretty clear. And also, of course, he referred to religion as the opiate or opium of the masses. Lenin, who echoed Marx in just about everything, in fact, communism is often referred to as Marxism-Leninism, he quoted Marx on this. He said, religion is the opium of the people. He said, religion is a kind of spiritual booze, right? Spiritual booze. And Lenin, even worse than that, said there is nothing more abominable than religion. There's nothing more abominable than religion. And he actually said, Don, all worship of a divinity is a necrophilia. Necrophilia. That sexual intercourse with a corpse, a dead human being. That's how much he hated religion. And he said too, and I quote a kind of milder, tamer Lenin from way back, well, 1905, that would have been a dozen years before the Bolshevik Revolution when he said some of these harsher things. But earlier, he also tried to warn people that even milder forms of socialism are not compatible with Christianity. And so not only did you have popes and religious people saying, hey, Christianity and socialism are incompatible, you actually have Lenin and Marx saying that as well. And our friends on the religious left today, they don't even realize that. They're completely ignorant of that history.
Max Lucado is a prolific author who has for years delighted readers young and old. He can be entertaining and he can be very deep. He is always thoughtful. He joined Kevin McCullough on AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
Your new book is titled How Happiness Happens, and it even has a happy cappuccino on it. It's literally a cappuccino with the two eyes and the smile of a smiley face in the middle of it. What is your interest in happiness?
Well, several things came together to pique my interest in happiness. I read a statistic 2 years ago. That's where all this began, with reading a statistic. Well, I can't even recall where I found it. I can tell you where it is now, but where I first read it, I don't know. That only one out of three Americans indicate that they're happy.
Hmm.
That really caught my attention. I guess I had suspected that, but does that surprise you that most people you see do not qualify?
The day and age that we live in, and remember, you came to New York voluntarily. I don't know. I guess it depends on how you measure what happiness means to people. But if it doesn't surprise me that there is a great amount of discontent and anxiety and anger and everything else that would kind of be the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. So I guess no. I guess I'm not surprised.
The consequences of that are pretty severe.
I'm sure.
Happier people are healthier. Happier people obviously have better relationships, stronger marriages. They tend to have stronger families. Happier people make more money. They're more successful in their career and at work. I mean, I guess nobody wants to hire somebody who's perpetually cranky. Happiness is an important topic, and it's really a serious topic because it affects us so much. And so that's what triggered my thoughts about, is there a way to generate, to help people access a greater level of happiness? And so I guess you could say I got all immersed. I did a deep dive into this topic, and it's a wonderful topic.
It is.
It is a wonderful. Who doesn't want to be happy? The number one class at Yale University is on happiness.
Wow.
So people are longing to be happy in this day and age, but it's that elusive virtue that keeps slipping past.
What do you suppose prevents people, at least on a surface level, from being as happy as they would like to be?
Now, there's two categories of response to that question. Some people are unhappy because of a deep, difficult circumstance they're facing.
Hmm.
You know, the death of a loved one, major health issues, crisis that comes into their life.
Circumstances they can't control.
That are very, very difficult, and I understand that. All of us have those moments. Most of our unhappiness on a day-to-day basis comes from things that we expect out of life that just simply don't go our way. The traffic issues, the bad weather, the cranky neighbor, things that we just don't like it. We just don't like it. And so we develop a certain expectation or level, and we spend much of our time trying to deal with that sense of unhappiness. And this is what I think happens, Kevin, is that we're told that if we can change our circumstance, we'll be happier. If I buy the new house or get a new spouse or get a new dog or get a new job, or if I can just change that one circumstance, things will be better, more money, more free time, more vacation time. And the truth of the matter is, it does help for a time, but it doesn't stick. It doesn't last. So we have to go back and do it again. and we have to go back and do it again. We have to go back. And we get on a cycle of pursuing happiness, but seldom finding it. And so what we need is a joy that's not contingent upon circumstance. One of the things that drives me crazy about reality TV shows these days is because that they promote this kind of happiness that will happen if the bachelor picks you or the bachelorette picks you or the housewife in New Jersey gets the new jewelry. I mean, it's just this.
Some of the most absurd stuff you can imagine.
It's just crazy.
Right.
It's just crazy. And I think it'd be really funny, except for the fact that we're raising a generation of kids who are buying into this.
Right.
And are saying, oh, that's how you find happiness. That's how you get it with the six-pack abs, you know. You get it by, I don't know, doing all that junk that they do. And that's simply not the case. Mm. It's simply not the case. So the sooner we can learn that there is a type of happiness that does not depend upon circumstance, the better off we'll be. Mm. And in the book, my big idea is that happiness happens when you give it away. Mm. Jesus said it really is more blessed to give than receive. And he uses a word there, blessed, that can be translated happy. It often is. And so he's saying that the happiest people are the ones who make it a practice of trying to make other people happy. Now, I can't control the weather. I cannot control who's in a particular political office. I cannot control so many things that are affecting me today. I was stuck on a tarmac for 45 minutes this morning. Mm. I couldn't control that. I would have liked to, but I couldn't. So am I going to let that suck the joy out of my life? Well, I hope not. I can control, however, the way I interact with you. Mm-hmm. Do I listen to you? Am I kind to you? Am I respectful of you? I can control if I'm going to encourage somebody, if I'm going to admonish someone or teach somebody or help somebody. These are the principles that the Bible gives us for really discovering a true and lasting either joy or happiness. And that is, it happens as we give that happiness to other people.
Is happiness something that we pursue, or is it something that happens to us? Or is it a combination of the two?
I think it is fair to pursue happiness because we understand that happiness makes me a better person. The trick is understanding what pursuit will truly generate happiness, right? Isn't that in our Declaration of Independence that we are all
the pursuit of happiness?
The pursuit of happiness.
Right.
And so the question is, what can I do to pursue happiness? And the beautiful thing, I think, about the Bible is that we have this practical list of one another verses in Scripture. Encourage one another, teach one another, greet one another, forgive one another. And these are human interaction 101 statements, Kevin, that help me become the kind of person that somebody would like to be with. When I do that, happiness will happen.
Hmm.
It really will. That's what Jesus meant, when I think, when he said, it's more blessed to give than receive.
Right.
So I can't force happiness. I can't really guarantee happiness, but boy, my goodness gracious, I can sure set myself up for it by putting these practical tools to use in trying to live a life that makes other people happy.
Go to ChristianOutlook.com for the entire conversation between Lucado and McCullough. Coming up,
every parent needs to know this, Satan hates your kids.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. As the 2020 presidential election heats up, many Christians have simply chosen not to participate. The sides are so divided, the nation is so polarized, it's no wonder that some want nothing to do with the rhetoric and spin and lies. But is that really the proper role for believers? Daniel Bennett covered this topic in an article he authored titled, How Christians Can Prepare for the 2020 Election. Bennett is a professor of political science and the assistant director of the Center for Faith and Flourishing at John Brown University. He explained his article on The Ride Home with John and Kathy on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
All of us have, you know, some variety of emotional trauma from 2016 because it was just, I would say, the worst of American politics on display. Now we're almost 4 years later. It doesn't seem like anything's gotten better as far as social interaction. And so I'm wondering how you look at your classroom full of college students and give them what? Hope? a directive? What are you telling them about this next election cycle?
Well, there's already anxiety on campus. We've been having discussions about how to promote better civil dialogue here on campus. We just had a discussion about that today. So we're getting ready for it. It's over a year away, but we're already sensing that sense of anxiety and tension on campus. The biggest thing from that piece is we have to remember where our identity ultimately lies. And it's a lot more complicated than that in practice, but it's also very simple. Mm-hmm. If we remember that we're Christians first, everything else should fall into place.
Yes. So to look at the world and ourselves as Christ-centered, first and foremost, as believers in Jesus, of course. But the problem, Daniel, and I know you know this, is that the president has surrounded himself with believers who, I mean, I'll just be, you know, who are less than, I believe, honorable men and women. I'm just going to be honest with that. That's my perspective, which is what causes me to have this anxiety, because it makes me anxious to see, you know, people up there who are whispering into the president's ears who I think, really, you're believers.
Yeah, no, it can be frustrating for people of faith to see the public witness, at least of, you know, the broader public witness to a culture who might not be familiar with the faith portrayed in a negative way. But ultimately, we can control our own interactions with others and our own witness to others. And so I think that's where we need to refocus some of this conversation, because some of it's out of our control,
right,
ultimately.
Right. Thank you.
Let's talk about negative partisanship. I mean, yeah. I'd ask you to define the phrase, but I'm pretty sure that we can all,
all right.
We can all figure out what it means.
So imagine you're a sports fan like I am. And
what's
I
your
really
team?
Liked it. So as a college football fan, I'm from Oregon, so I'm an Oregon Ducks fan.
Sure.
That's
okay.
My team. And I love to see Oregon win. I really like to see the University of Washington lose.
Mm,
sure. That's really
satisfying.
Nice for me.
Oh,
satisfying,
yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, apply that same mentality to politics and governance, and you see where we are. Right, you take more pleasure in seeing the other side suffer a defeat or a humiliation.
Sure.
Than actually take pleasure in good policy making or compromise.
Right.
And that's a problem.
Yeah, that is a problem. You know, I thought about that a lot over the last month. We've had a couple guests on our show from Comment Magazine who've talked about the difficulty of building something and just how long it takes to create something, whether you're creating a bit of art or you're working on a dinner or you're starting a new business or whatever it is. It just takes a long time to build something. But tearing something down is the easiest, fastest thing in the world. And so when I think about how it is that we talk about ideas or how we talk about politics or politicians, it is so much easier to just go after somebody than it is to be a person who's trying to come up with a policy.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's exacerbated in a sense by social media, mm-hmm. where, you know, something that's sensational or seen as a huge zing on a person can go viral pretty quickly, whereas a more constructive critique complemented by constructive criticism about actual policy kind of flies under the radar.
Right.
It's much sexier, excuse my language, to go after someone in a negative way.
Right.
Daniel Bennett's with us from John Brown University. So then, Daniel, as this is incumbent upon us and 2020 looms, how as we then, as believers, how can we align ourselves to be Christ-like in all of our conversations, our thoughts, our prayers, as we look to the next election?
Yeah, you know, so I offered three ideas or three things to look for. You know, the first and foremost is to see whoever you're talking to, whether you agree with them, disagree with them, whatever, as made in the image of God, because ultimately they are made in the image of God. And this is simple in a sense, and it should apply to more than just politics. We should also attempt as Christians, especially as Christians, to listen and to listen well to others with whom we disagree. This doesn't mean sacrificing our own beliefs or our own values, but trying to understand where people are coming from with humility, but also with the confidence that comes in Christ, knowing that all truth is God's truth.
Right.
And then lastly, we embrace our identity in Christ as the ultimate essence of who we are, not the outcome of an election.
Raising kids to be healthy, God-loving adults is not easy, especially in today's climate. For a little help, Georgine Rice invited Jeffrey Dean on her program. Dean wrote the book, Raising Successful Teens, How to Help Your Child Honor God and Live Wisely. They discuss the many challenges on the Georgene Rice Show on KPDQ in Portland, Oregon.
You know, I appreciate the subtitle of the book because it gives hope to parents and observers of teenagers who are very concerned how to help your child honor God and live wisely. It presumes that it's possible for both of those things, in fact, to be the case.
Well, we really love the title, the subtitle as well. But we really want to offer hope and help to parents and to remind them that whether your kid's on the honor roll or on meth, hey, God has a plan for you, for your family, for your kids. Your kid's situation is of no surprise to him. He's in it with you. And that's why throughout the book, we really pack biblical truth and just a lot of scripture to help parents understand. It really begins with your walk with God. To be the parent that your kid wants you to be, more importantly, who God's created you to be, really begins with your walk with the Lord. And that's why I start at the first chapter, challenging parents to be all in when it comes to their desire to want to know God and want to live for him more.
Yeah. Well, the book is filled with hope, but it also gives really good instruction. And I think that's what parents need, both of those things in one volume. In the introduction of the book, you begin by writing about a 15-year-old girl that you knew several years ago. She was someone who was involved in youth group. She was a believer and so on. But the new culture encourages kids to take pictures of themselves without their clothes on. And she had engaged in that, which just gives you a picture of how fragile it can be for some young people in knowing where to draw the line or being willing to draw the line, even if they appear to be very involved in following Christ, and that's their heart's desire.
Yeah, we start with that story. It's a tough place to start. My mama read that story, and she said, "Wow, Jeffy, that's a really tough story to begin with." And it is for every parent who will read this book. It's a tough place to begin, but it's an important one.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I don't write trying to pull on the heartstrings of parents. I'm not trying to create an emotional moment to draw them into the book. I want parents to know from moment one, listen, it doesn't matter if your kid's doing really good in school or has dropped out of school. It doesn't really matter whether they've started dating or not. All those things are just a part of teen life, and everyone's story is different. But reality is, what does matter for this book is that every parent needs to know this. Satan hates your kids. And he's going to work every day to steal, kill, and destroy, as Jesus warned in John 10:10. And so every kid is just one choice away from consequence, only one turn from tragedy. We want every parent to know that your kids, they need you in it every day with them. They're counting on you. They're looking to you. Influence is so important because every day Satan wants to destroy your family, wants to bring down your kids in the process.
Coming up, the restoration of America.
It begins from the bottom up. It begins with marriages, families, and parents.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. The Christian Outlook podcast brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969 or click on the banner ad at ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. As we look out on the American culture, it's easy to drift to the feeling that there's little or no hope for our country. But as believers, that's not who we are. Hope is critical. And we know quite well that Jesus restores individuals, and he can certainly restore a nation. For a discussion on his book, American Restoration, How Faith, Family, and Personal Sacrifice Can Heal Our Nation, Tim Gagline sat in on the Frank Sontag Show on KKLA in Los Angeles.
What's transpiring in our country, especially over the last handful of years, it seems like we hear so much about division and strife. From your perspective, what do you see going on in America?
Well, Frank, it's so tempting to say that this is, you know, the most divided we've ever been. And whether you're in an audience of liberals and progressives or conservatives and traditionalists, that's the temptation. But the reality is that Americans have been, in several hinges of history, very divided. You know, in the American Revolution, one-third of Americans did not support the revolution. You know, 750,000 people died in the Civil War. The social and moral revolution of the 1960s, major divisions over Vietnam and Watergate. So we have been, you know, divided before. Our politics has been poisonous the largest historical question is, what is the way forward? What kind of a country do we want 50 years from now? And frankly, the issue that we raise in our book is, how do we restore the country? How do we renew and regenerate a really great country? What are the steps we have to take toward American restoration? And that's why we chose it as the title of our book.
You're emphatic and clear in your statement saying, look, let's be careful about what we buy into, especially as the way the mainstream media reports what's going on in our country.
Well, I think that's right. And I think just the last 2 weeks is a very good example. A journalist who I respect a lot said, you know, if we were looking at the fate and state of American journalism regarding Justice Kavanaugh, you'd say, you know, impeach American journalism. So, you know, we have a lot of challenges, needless to say. But I am absolutely a hopefulist to the core. I believe that America's best days are genuinely ahead of us, not because I'm a confetti-to-the-wind optimist. It's just I believe that restoration and renewal and regeneration in a great country like ours, even with all the difficulties, Frank, I do believe that restoration is probable. And the largest question, as I say, is how do we get there?
Okay. Not that it's an easy answer, but I'll pose the question, how do we in part begin to get there?
Well, this is the answer, if I may say, that our book, you know, seeks to answer. And the thing we decidedly do not do is we say it's not going to be a conservative version of a top-down fix like the Great Society, you know, or right. or the New Deal. It begins from the bottom up. It begins with marriages, families, and parents. It begins in churches and in synagogues. It begins in communities and neighborhoods where we live. All of the seedlings of restoration begin in the home, in the neighborhood, and where we live and work. You know, and that's why in our book, Frank, we say you have to restore the United States Constitution. You have to restore the family. You have to restore civility. I mean, may I say, just basically, in the way, in, you know, I love your question. You know, we have to find a way nationally to restore civility in the public square. In other words, we really can disagree agreeably. There's a way to do that, and we have to do it, left or right. It's something that we have to have a national commitment to, because otherwise we will remain in a kind of cold civil war, and that's not decidedly worthy of a great country like the United States.
But, Tim, anybody tuning in, I would think a lot of listeners are going, man, I can kind of breathe a sigh of relief because I just hear doom and gloom 24/7.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because despair and discouragement is a sin. It negates the hope of Jesus Christ. It negates the hope that there is a possible way forward. And whether I'm speaking to an audience of progressives or conservatives, after I finish my remarks, typically, the hands go up and people will say the following: I've never been more concerned about my country.
Right.
If they have children or grandchildren, they right. say, I've never been more concerned about the country that I'm leaving them. But most importantly, Frank, they say, and I don't know what to do. I said, let's do a book that doesn't talk about all the problems. Let's do a book that talks about the solution. Let's talk about a practical way that real people who care about the country can read in a way that speaks to them and says, here is a practical way to help restore America.
For the entire conversation with Tim Gagline of Focus on the Family, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up, the Dead Sea Scrolls.
They are the only documents that we have that were physically copied during the lifetime of our Lord.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who impact public policy and serve in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. As the world turns away from God, it seems he drops reminders throughout history that he is here. Professor John Bergsma wrote a fascinating book titled Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, revealing the Jewish roots of Christianity. It's an encouraging look at a critical discovery of documents written thousands of years ago. John and Kathy return for a conversation with Professor Bergsma.
I think most of us know the term Dead Sea Scrolls, but probably we don't understand exactly what they are and where they were discovered. So let's start there.
So the Dead Sea Scrolls came to light in probably the winter of 1947 into 1948, when some Bedouin shepherds were driving their flocks of goats along the shores of the Dead Sea, and one of them tossed a rock into a cave, heard some breaking of pottery, and thought there were some probably some human artifacts in there. They were hoping especially for gold. So they climbed in, looked around, and were very disappointed to pull out just three old scrolls. So one of those scrolls turned out to be a complete copy of the book of Isaiah from about 1,000 years earlier than any complete copy of a biblical book in Hebrew that we had ever had before. But after about a half a year, the scrolls got into the hands of some scholars from Hebrew University in Jerusalem and some scholars back in the U.S., and they suddenly realized what they had. And the excitement started to set in earnest.
1,000 years earlier than any documents we'd ever had before then? 1,000 years?
And there they sat undisturbed.
Yeah, they were sitting in a cave 1,000 years earlier than any manuscript of the Bible in Hebrew that we had had. Our oldest copies of the Old Testament in Hebrew dated from about 1,000 A.D. Suddenly, with these scrolls, we're looking at, 250 B.C. As a possible date for what we call the Great Isaiah Scroll, which is kind of the piece de resistance of the whole collection. It was, as I said, a complete copy of Isaiah. So that's really astounding to move 1,000, maybe even a little bit more, maybe up to 1,200 years earlier in terms of your manuscript witness to a book like Isaiah. And, of course, fragments of many other biblical books were found there, as well as, about 700 manuscripts of religious writings from a sect of Judaism that scholars call the Essenes, who are kind of a holiness sect that practiced monasticism and celibacy and built communities like the one that that they dug up there on the shores of the Dead Sea.
The Dead Sea Scrolls are important, I'm sure, for a lot of reasons, but from your perspective, most important, why?
They're most important for the light that they shed on the gospel. You know, speaking as a Christian, I'm always, of course, interested in ancient discoveries that help us to understand the Bible better. And for years, I really didn't understand why the scrolls were so significant, because I was using them primarily to shed light on the Old Testament, mm-hmm. which actually, the real interest of the scrolls is in New Testament scholarship, because they are the only documents that we have that were physically copied during the lifetime of our Lord. You know, we have many things that were composed during the lifetime of Jesus, but these were physically written down while, you know, St. Paul was preaching, while Jesus was walking the shores of Galilee, and even earlier. Because of that, they give us kind of an unvarnished, you know, clear window into the thought world and the religious practice of Jews in the time of Jesus. And, of course, that's very helpful for elucidating certain parts of the New Testament and just kind of getting that, understanding that world.
What do we know about New Testament life that we didn't know before we had the scrolls?
Well, we had some information about this mysterious group that the Jewish historian Josephus calls the Essenes, and but we didn't know how seriously to take what Josephus described. You know, was he being fanciful? Was this a group that really existed? Well, with the discovery of the scrolls and the archaeology that was done on the community down below the caves from where the scrolls were found, we've discovered that, oh my goodness, Josephus was being serious, because what had the way that he describes this community fits with the archaeology and fits also the internal witness from the scrolls. So one of the things that really brought home was that there was indeed, for example, a Jewish group practicing celibacy and living a common life during the years of Jesus' ministry. And that sheds a lot of light, for example, in Matthew 19, where Jesus describes those who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He's not talking about a future group that would do that. He's talking about some of his contemporaries that have done that. That's probably one of the most direct references to the Essenes that we can identify in the Gospels, because we know that the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and other groups of Jews weren't practicing that kind of lifestyle, but the Essenes certainly were. Also, in many ways, the language of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the phrases that they use, some of the concepts that they employ, show that these words, phrases, ideas are indeed very Jewish and come from the time of Jesus or even a century earlier. And thus, many parts of the New Testament, like the Gospel of John, St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, parts of Luke, parts of Matthew that were long thought to be kind of late and fictional, maybe from a second or a third generation of Christians. Now, by comparing their language to the scrolls, you're like, oh my goodness, no, these are not late at all. This is actually how Jews thought and spoke in the lifetime of Jesus, and there's no reason to think that these things are late or fraudulent.
Really? So in many ways, John, the scrolls showed Jesus in an intimate way because they were written by someone who was very close to that time.
Take, for example, the Gospel of John. There's many phrases in the Gospel of John, like spirit of truth, spirit of falsehood, sons of light, sons of darkness. These were, again, thought to be the, you know, indications that the Gospel of John was late because it wasn't believed that the first generation of Christians spoke like this. But those kind of phrases we find in very important documents from the Dead Sea Scrolls, written in Hebrew, written, you know, up to a century before our Lord and during the time of Jesus himself. And most scholars now acknowledge, yes, the Gospel of John reads like a document that would have been written by a Jew whose lifetime, you know, overlapped with Jesus's. And that's a big shift from what it was 100 years ago.
Coming up, Donald Trump stands up for believers.
The first president in history to give a speech at the United Nations devoted solely to religious freedom.
Details when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Christians today face unbelievable persecution worldwide. Oddly, much of it is ignored by the mainstream media. But it caught the attention of President Donald Trump. And he took his grievance directly to the United Nations this past week. Here's Bob Burney on WRFD 880 in Columbus, Ohio.
To my knowledge, the first president in history to give a speech at the United Nations devoted solely to religious freedom. It was historic, and yet the mainstream media either ignored it or criticized him for it. For instance, our own Channel 10 here in Columbus on their webpage today. Here is the headline from Channel 10. At UN, Trump focuses on religious freedom, not climate. First paragraph. President Donald Trump made his political priorities clear Monday within an hour of arriving at the United Nations for a three-day visit. He breezed by a major climate change summit, and that is in red letters, to focus instead on religious persecution, an issue that resonates with his evangelical supporters. So in other words, according to Channel 10, religious freedom and persecution, it's only important to a bunch of religious fanatics. Those are the only people who care about it. And then we have USA Today. Trump pushes religious freedom theme at UN, but critics say it clashes with his own record at home. It was a great speech. It really was. My only disappointment with the president's speech was he didn't name names. He didn't mention China. He didn't mention North Korea. He did not mention some of the worst violators of religious freedom in the world. But he announced $25 million in funding to protect religious freedom. He said
We're urging every nation to increase the prosecution and punishment of crimes against religious communities. There could be no greater crime than that. Too often people in positions of power preach diversity while silencing, shunning, or censoring the faithful. True tolerance means respecting the right of all people to express their deeply held religious beliefs. Then he said, let's get this. This is from President Trump. An estimated 11 Christians are killed every single day for following the teachings of Christ. 11 Christians die every day simply because they are followers of Jesus Christ. And according to the mainstream media, that's not really important. It's only important to his evangelical supporters.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posian and Michael Cook, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook. But it flew away from her reach, so she ran away in a sleep. Dream of para, para, paradise, para, para, paradise.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.